SBS Radio.
I'm joined on NITV Radio by Dr. Stephen Gubbs, historian and author, to talk about his latest book, Gudiara, The First Wiradjuri War of Resistance, The Bathurst War, 1822-1824. Gudiara traces the coordinated resistance warfare by the Wiradjuri people under the leadership of Windradine and other Aboriginal warriors in vast expanses across Central West New South Wales. The book also details the far-reaching counterattacks by the colonists and their punitive expeditions that often ended in indiscriminate massacres of Wiradjuri people, including the killing of women and children. Stephen Gubbs, thanks for joining us on NITV Radio.
Thank you.
Now, this is a book that actually tells the story of Wiradjuri wars. We didn't know about this in our national narrative. It's a hidden part of Australia's history that you bring out. Tell us about this book.
Well, it's not quite hidden because Wiradjuri people have known this story for a long time, obviously, but hidden from the main stories of particularly that narrative of the colonisation, the expansion of the colony west across the Blue Mountains from Sydney. That story has always, you know, in schools and elsewhere, as in the past, always really much focused upon the explorers going across the mountains and then the sheep and cattle coming across the mountains and the amazing grasslands and prosperity and progress that happened from really 1813, this process of taking Wiradjuri lands, that becomes the dominant story. But at the time, the resistance against that was actually quite significant. Well, I guess the beginning of the story is really why one of the questions that straight away rose for me was why did this the first Europeans come across the mountains in the 1810s, 1813, 1815, Governor Macquarie comes across, a few settlers come across, but there's no immediate resistance. There's no pushback from Wiradjuri people straight away. It takes until 1821, 1822, before there's a really strong pushback and conflict and violence occurs. So what the first question for me was, why does it take so long? And that becomes obvious in the book. But then in that period, in 1823 and 24, there's a significant fight back targeting particularly sheep and cattle. But then in 1824, the stock workers, particularly around the outstations around Bathurst, they come under attack and they're killed. And there's a, I think it's a really important moment where Wiradjuri people are saying to the colonists, we are going to tumble down the white man. And I think, for me, that's kind of like, it's a point of declaration of war. We've had enough, and they're threatening to kill all the white men around Bathurst. And in 1824, there's a really intense period of warfare. Governor Brisbane has to declare martial law and send a large military force out there. The resistance is led by a warrior called Windradine, but there's also several other resistance leaders in different areas around the Central West. And an amazing thing that I found was that the coordination between those different forces, Windradine and Blucher, and several others, Simon, Joe, Jingler, they all fight back in a coordinated resistance in 1824 that the Europeans, the colonists, have to suppress. So that's kind of the overview of what happens. Obviously, they're defeated by superior military forces, the use of firearms, and by massacres. There's a point where armed settlers go out into the region and, you know, there's a quote from one of them who says, "We shot and killed indiscriminately." When you're faced with armed and mounted settlers shooting women, men, women, and children indiscriminately, it's really hard to keep fighting back. And so Windradine has to sue for peace effectively in 1824. And that's when that period of warfare ends. And that's what I cover in the book pretty much.
Yeah, one would argue that maybe the war, the conflict reached its highest peak because of maybe competition for land, competition for resources, because these ships are coming on really grasslands that were used by Aboriginal people. Because it also tells another side of the story about our national narrative, whereby we just see the Wiradjuri people or all other Indigenous peoples as hunter-gatherers, but they had also sophisticated ways of managing land, and even the warfare that you describe, it's not just it's some often told acts of marauding or just random fights. It's a structured military structures that maybe are different from the European way of warfare, but they had their lines of command, lines of communication, and all that. So it's still a more sophisticated side of the Wiradjuri people than we would normally read about.
No, that's so true. I mean, there's been some great work, obviously, particularly from people like Bruce Pascoe, about understanding the sophistication of First Nations agriculture, for example. Myself and a few other historians, and particularly a Wiradjuri historian, Angus Murray, we're trying to understand and seeing the complexity of the, as you said, the military strategy and tactics of warriors at this time and elsewhere across the country. It's also been overlooked and dismissed. You've mentioned a few examples. The communication networks were incredible. Using lines of sight from hilltop to hilltop, communicating with smoke signals, with mirrors, and designated systems of military rank, all these sort of complexities that we think about in European military systems are there in very different ways, but very effective ways when push comes to shove. And we mustn't forget too that First Nations people, Wiradjuri people, were very much a warrior culture as well.
Yeah, and you also mentioned alliances with other, because it started with a one core group, and some stages you had actually alliances with other tribal groups, and you had really massive coordinated attacks from multiple fronts.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. We might be familiar with First Nations in the United States forming alliances. I think the dominant narrative or story here has been that one of the reasons why Aboriginal people couldn't fight back successfully, and this is what a lot of military historians have said, was because they couldn't ally with each other because of traditional disagreements or whatever and distances. In fact, when you look into the historical record, it's there, it's obvious. Alliances are being formed across vast distances, hundreds of kilometres from different nation groups to fight back. And in fact, it's now being argued that the coordination of different nation groups across vast distances is probably unique in the world. Nowhere else... That I know of, such distances of people coming together and coordinating from different nation groups in a resistance warfare situation doesn't occur. It's in the United States, for example, they're usually much smaller distances apart. So I think that's quite an interesting and unique feature of this part of the frontier wars and elsewhere. Windradyne has been seen as the leader of the Bathurst Wars, and I do want to make the point too that there were other leaders, but he seems to have definitely been the most prominent leader. He also is the most well-recorded leader because he has a relationship with one settler family, the Sutters. In the pastoralists and the wealthy stock breeders and owners who went across often didn't settle on the land that they'd occupied, Wiradjuri land they'd occupied. They often just sent convicts over as shepherds to work on their farms, whereas the Sutters, they actually moved their whole family and they lived there. And they were one of the few families who realised that to successfully farm, they needed to engage with Wiradjuri people who were important to their to understanding the landscape, to you know, the seasons, the pasture, everything. So Windjardine had a relationship with the Sutters, and the story that's told by the Sutter family, and I was very fortunate to be able to talk to Uncle Bill Allen Jr., who's a descendant of Windjardine, and to get kind of both sides of the story, I suppose. There's a point in 1824 where it seems to me that Wiradjuri people have realised that the Europeans are coming across, the cattle and sheep are growing in numbers and numbers, and they need to work out different ways to survive, to eat. So the spearing, the taking and spearing, the spearing and killing and eating of one or two sheep or cattle, I think to Wiradjuri people seems almost like, well, it's paying the rent. You've got tens of thousands of cattle. Why can't we just take one? In British law and British eyes, that is a crime. And that causes a lot of conflict. There's also part of the context is that several of those absentee stockholders, landowners, really foster the idea amongst the convicts, and they arm the convicts to guard their stock. And they allow them to shoot Wiradjuri people who are stealing sheep or killing cattle. And that kind of develops a situation where I think the convict stock workers think that it's okay to kill, that black lives don't matter. So that situation develops, and Windjardine's family, Windjardine's not there, but his family members are taking some potatoes from a potato field near Bathurst on the floodplains of the Macquarie-Wombul River, which traditionally would have been a rich yam field, a tended, traditional Wiradjuri agricultural field. And the first time they asked, and then the next day they came back, they didn't ask, thought it was okay to take some potatoes from the potato field, and the owner got upset and called settlers together and basically shot this family group down. It's been known as the potato field incident. I call it the Bathurst Massacre. There's been a lot of small-scale conflict before this, but this really seems to spark Windjardine into action and vengeance. And he goes on a raid and attacks several settlers' properties at once. But the story goes that he goes to the Sutter property and leaves them aside because they have been considerate to Wiradjuri people, but goes and attacks and kills. You know, there's 20 convict workers in 1824 been killed. He kills seven in a spree on one night around the north of Bathurst, and so causes complete chaos in the township of Bathurst when a cart is full of seven bodies of white men comes through the township. But that sparks Windjardine into a guerrilla war occurs around the north of Bathurst, and then there's other conflict around the northwest led by Blücher, to the south by Simon and Joe. We don't know their traditional names. And, yeah, there's a period of attacks and retreats into the terrain around Bathurst, which if you know the area, to the south towards Blaney, there's a rolling hills. To the north and east, there's the mountains and the Kapiti area around towards Mudgee. The settlers, the colonists constantly complain that they can't get to the warriors because they retreat into these rocky terrain areas. So this guerrilla warfare campaign is conducted really skillfully, and the colonists complain they need more military, they need more firearms, and they need horses. And that becomes one of the key elements of this, of defeating this guerrilla warfare. That guerrilla warfare could have gone on for much longer without the quick use of armed mounted settlers with horses. Horses become the key. In fact, this warfare around Bathurst in 1824 sparks the calls for a cavalry force. They wanted initially to call it a colonial cavalry. It becomes, in effect, the mounted police. And that's what really rules the frontier wars after this.
And you mentioned also an incident where the military commander of the time was asking for horses from his hierarchy. The response from them was to use oxen to carry out attacks. How can you use an ox to mount a military attack? This has never been done before in history.
Yeah, we're not quite. It was more to do as pack animals, as supply animals for the infantry marching around. They wanted pack horses, but the authorities in Sydney said, well, you've got lots of cattle. Why not just use cattle? And the military commander there, Morissette, was you could see he was quite upset at the suggestion they should use cattle as pack animals. But that the military itself is obviously in want of horses to be a more mobile force to meet the Wiradjuri, the warriors who know the terrain, who can rapidly move throughout and communicate long distances. So they need to they find that, you know, that cattle as supply animals is not the most successful method.
It's not as agile and doesn't move as quickly as a horse, and it's cannot train it to be also.
In fact, it's not the military, the redcoats or the soldiers who end up, ending the conflict, the Wiradjuri War of Resistance. It's the armed settlers who do that, and they've got horses and they've got firearms. The military are mostly infantry marching around. They can't catch up with Wiradjuri warriors. It's the armed settlers who go out and conduct. You know, they're basically massacre parties. Go out and hunt down and try and kill anyone to terrorize. They wanted to strike terror into these people so they won't kill their sheep and cattle and workers. The military are quite hopeless in many ways in this situation. But then they work out that they need a cavalry force, and that's what generates that, becomes the mounted police.
You really bring that out very clearly in the book, and there's an aspect of different protagonists, the convicts, the settlers, and the military. But without the military, there wouldn't have been such a successful extermination, because in the different phases that you described, the convicts was like hit and run and massacres and small-scale massacres that could go on forever, as you said, until the military came in. There was a more structured kind of campaign.
Well, the military is the backbone, and the first kind of strategy is to send out, to have small garrisons in all around the area of, you know, sometimes just three or four soldiers. But what they effectively do, very effectively do, is three or four soldiers might not seem like a strong force, but when you have a convict overseer who's mounted and armed, three or four other convicts who have firearms, suddenly, when you've got a force of 10 muskets, 10 firearms, that's a significant force. And it's got the backbone of three or four redcoats. This is a strategy that's deployed by the British all around the globe in their empire, using what's called auxiliary forces. And in this case, in Australia, it's not well known, it's not well studied at all, how the British used their convict workers as part of stiffening their military formations as their auxiliary forces in this conflict. So I think that's something that needs to be considered. The way that we think of the convict workforce is a bit more complicated than just being kind of slaves to the pastoralists or whatever. They had a stake in all this too, and often they were in the outstations, deep in Wiradjuri country, undefended, and so they were the first line of defence in many ways for the military.
You also mentioned a few convicts and settlers who can think of someone like Rodrigo that you mentioned. There are others as well that don't come to mind very quickly. who actually really carried out horrific crimes.
You know, we know a couple. Rodrigo, basically, he's the potato farmer, and he admits that he gathered settlers and shot people. An ex-sergeant, an ex-military man, Thomas Miller, he later... See, what happens is the settlers don't really write about it or talk about it because why would you want to? You might not be taken to trial for killing people. They were in a situation where there had been people sent to Sydney for trial, and Thomas Miller was one of them, and they were let off because of lack of evidence, right? So there was a situation where people thought they could get away with it, but they still had to be careful because, as we know later on at Mile Creek, people did get were hanged for massacring Aboriginal people. So they knew it was ultimately against the law, but there was an encouragement at the time, I think, to do it. People like Thomas Miller, they write about it 20, 30, 40, 50 years later in their memoirs, and that's where they admit to a lot of these killings. That's where most of the evidence for it is. At the time, it's kind of swept under the carpet, and I think that's what happens with the military as well. There's no official report into this by the governor. The authorities in London, meanwhile, they're asking, what's happening? Why is there a war going on in Bathurst? And everyone admits there's a war going on in Bathurst. But there's no official report about casualties, about who killed who. It's swept aside, and I think that's a real neglect of their duty and role by Morissette, who's the commandant at Bathurst, and by Governor Brisbane, who is very soon after recalled back to London. So a lot of the evidence is not there. It's been very difficult to piece this together from looking at, and often, as I was explaining, the strongest evidence we can find for those massacres is from settlers admitting it later on in life when they think it's all over and they're successful, they're founders of townships, they're regarded as pioneers, and that's when they can start to talk about the massacres and killings that went on.
Yeah, and this highlights also maybe the beginning of the conflict, which I'm assuming could be the double standard of the justice system, whereby some of these raids on Aboriginal people went unpunished, and Aboriginal people, the Wiradjuri people, maybe felt, well, these people who are sent to, you mentioned a few who are sent to Sydney, went through the court system and released back into the community. Then the settler, the Wiradjuri people would come back and feel, what's going on? And maybe carry out revenge attacks.
You can only imagine the time that Thomas Miller admitted that he fired and shot and killed an Aboriginal person who was taking sheep. We don't know exactly what was raiding on a farm. He was sent to Sydney for trial, and his family, his Wiradjuri family members, came to the Commandant Lawson at the time and said, "We want justice." And in their minds, they wanted to either kill Tom Miller for killing their family member or some of his children. And that's what they said to Lawson. Lawson said, no, he's gone to Sydney for trial. Now, he comes back a free man. How would they have felt? You know, this is another episode that obviously fuels that situation where Wiradjuri people must have begun to believe that nothing was going to stop the colonization of their country. Nothing was going to provide justice for them, and that's where resistance warfare, you know, comes out.
You mentioned an incident where a particular massacre where the men actually put the women and children in safety in the neighborhood, and then the women and children got massacred. What happened to those who killed those women and children?
Nothing. We only have the stories of that, and we can only piece together that it was possibly the armed party that Thomas Miller writes about later that did that massacre. We don't know. People didn't admit to it. Some of the survivors of the massacre were young children. Their descendants are some of the people I spoke to about this, and they have strong memories and stories about the massacre. But of course, a three-year-old child who survives the massacre is not going to know who it was, who the perpetrators. But I would like to think that the publication of the book will bring out some more stories, perhaps, that haven't been told. I'd also like to think that it will generate a stronger interest in that history that might involve conducting further archaeology into some of the potential sites where we might find more information about the people involved, and at least acknowledge and commemorate this war that happened.
Most definitely, because as a historian, you use multiple sources, and one source that is not well actually explored is usually the passing on of oral history from generation to generation. This is something that's very strong in indigenous cultures. Then you have to piece this with the archives. Are these archives well-kept and readily accessible?
The state archives and the state library and that kind of material, that is well-kept and accessible. The more local archives, I had to spend a lot of time in, for example, the Bathurst Museum archives, other local areas. Those not so well kept or accessible, but I think they're still growing in many ways. I think in some settler colonist descendants' family histories, I think there may be some more information to be gathered. But yeah, piecing all this together, I think it's really important. It's a really important task of historians now, particularly frontier wars historians, to consider, you know, all the forms of archives. And not just historical written records, but also it's really important to talk with people whose country and whose history it was. But it's also it's also important to understand the landscape that this occurs on, because I think that definitely gave me some more indicators about what was happening on the ground. Just being able to see where the terrain changes and why it was defensible, why a valley could be at once a refuge and a massacre site, why a mountaintop could communicate with another one when you stand on top of them and you see how the distances and the communication networks that were possible. Understanding that kind of archive of the landscape is really important as well.
Just to conclude with the story of Windradyne coming to Parramatta with his fighters, looking at the way he was treated and comparing with Palawa fighter Tongalongeta, who was actually depicted in a recent book by Henry Reynolds, who came to Hobart and signed an armistice. But Windradyne was not afforded the same courtesy of signing a peace deal, but I see it as a betrayal at the end when he came to Parramatta, ended up the way he ended.
He obviously comes, he marches across the mountains with 140 Wiradjuri people to meet the governor and to sue for peace. Now, it's obvious he's expecting something out of that arrangement. He comes as an equal military leader to the governor. What he gets is a feast and some promises of peace and some blankets, some presents. There is no agreement. There is no stopping any further colonization to the west of Bathurst. It's just business as usual. It's not a peace at all. It's just, business as usual.
The colonization of the country continued. Place became prosperous, and all of a sudden the wars became kind of forgotten, and now we're retelling them. Is that how it could summarize the situation? Is that a proper summary?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of good work happening in terms of talking about. There's been a lot of, and rightly so, a lot of focus on finding the extent of massacres that occurred. I also think the relationship between resistance and massacre needs more exploration. We need to understand the resistance that went as well and the massacres. And I think that's an important step that we're moving towards, yeah.
Yeah, Stephen Cupps, thank you so much for talking to us today. And congratulations on this really riveting book, which I highly recommend to our listeners.
Thank you very much.
Want to hear more stories like this? Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.